interview with Leroy Collins, former governor of Florida, May 19th, 1974, Tallahassee, Florida.
And then there was a Republican, Gurney. He was ready-made for him because he had this opposition from Crystal Lodge. He had no opposition himself because he'd never made any kind of record.
The fact that your opposition in that Democratic primary just labeled you as being at Selma and associated you very closely with your role in
that, and I was a liberal.
Well, that worked.
Gurney said was, well, this choice is simple in this race. He's a liberal and I'm a conservative. Make your choice.
Governor, would that work today?
Not
six
as
years
well,
later.
I don't think, but it still has its strength.
And the liberal-conservative difference was based on race?
Yes, sir. Almost
wholly. Is that as strong
almost
today?
Almost wholly. My record actually is quite conservative in fiscal matters. So I've been quite liberal in the area of human relations. But I get quite upset, really, now with the trend toward just over-bureaucratization, mushrooming. Climate and all in government. I think the federal government, the state government, and the local governments are just kind of going along wild. It would seem that way, because I'm not in touch with it, and I don't want to be like some people I've known that after they went off the scene, well, they never did feel like things went quite well since. I think a great deal of asking it is fine. But this, I don't know whether he's really deeply concerned about this, and the proportions of it are fantastic. I think far beyond any normal need or normal relationship, population growth, or any of these other factors. And one of the big reasons for it is the legislature, because it's led the way. It's a totally different thing than it used to be, and in some respects, it's argued that it's much better, but I don't know. To me, it's
everybody that
it's
we've
better.
Talked to says it's better.
I think it's better. At the same time, I think they've lost something because they've lost the position of being a check against the other phases of government, executive in particular, the administrative. And they create their own staffs to the extent that they have. And I hope you can just go down there and go through the offices and they just crawl out and open, you know, staff people for legislators. And I didn't see this in the paper, but somebody told me it came out in the paper the other day that they're going to pay $2,000 for individual desks in the House that they're going to do that over, and that they will have individual television, closed circuit television sets for each desk, and just all kinds of things that, to me, is not in line with the conservative approach to expenditures that certainly we should have in a time when we've got inflation. In a time when paying taxes is very difficult for the people, very difficult, because it's getting pinched too many ways what their income is. But I mentioned that starting because I was pointing out that I actually am right conservative, I think, in many aspects of my thinking, but in the area of human relations, in the area of getting something done about the disadvantage that these blacks have had and getting them to a level that they can participate with any semblance of equal opportunity, I'm really strong in that area, because I think that's been the great, really great failure of this country since its beginning, is not rectifying that.
You think it was the race issue that defeated you?
Yes, no doubt about it.
You think that could happen again today in Florida? An open attempt to defeat somebody on the basis of race?
Well,
it remains to be seen, because last year everybody decided they didn't want race talked at all. And there was no issue made. The blacks didn't even make an issue. They just didn't, nobody wanted to, you know, this is when the last time we elected a governor, when Askew ran. He didn't have to get involved at all in this area. And there was no criticism back and forth, or no, and the blacks themselves were rather submerged. They weren't demanding, you know, positions from the candidates and this kind of thing. And so it was, the people had just been fed up with it in my campaign and the other campaigns that went at that time. See, Wallace was running at the same time I was, and unpopular Nixon was running at the same time I was. And this, subsequently, they changed the times of the election of governors now to the off years, to the, when they're not having the federal elections. It would have helped me if that hadn't been so, if we hadn't had them all at the same time. Wallace was tremendously popular in Florida. He drew many more crowds and a great deal more vocal support and obvious support than any of the candidates for president.
Was the fact that Wallace was campaigning actively for president in 68 when you were making your Senate race, did that hurt you in the sense of bringing fully to the surface all the submerged racial feelings?
Yes, sir. It sure did. And it hurt me in the sense that the Wallace people were organized and they were getting their people out to vote. And they had a real strong campaign and well-financed. And every time they got somebody to oppose the vote, they weren't voting for me.
But you think that race issue would work again in a statewide campaign? You think it submerged forever, or was that just an aberration?
Well, I think if I ran, it would surface again pretty strongly. I made a speech last night right there in that hotel where you were staying, to a group of the Florida Voters League, their closing banquet. And this kind of, what I said there would probably project that issue again, because they would see, they regard me as a kind of an extremist. I don't think I'm an extremist in that area. I think I'm in line with the Constitution, in line with the right. But still, Askew is not a man to get involved like, or say the things that I'll say, even. And Lawton Charles, when he was running for the United States Senate, he didn't say any of the things that I would say.
What was the thrust of your message last night?
Well, it was three parts. One, I made a review of what had happened in race relations since the, as kind of in line with the 20th anniversary of the Brown decision. And I rationalized what that had done with other Supreme Court decisions of the past. And I mentioned the involvement of the blacks and paid tribute to them so far as the progress that was made of following that, that this was not something that the people, just because of what they thought of in Sunday school or what they thought about the Constitution, were willing to support, that it took the pressures, the March on Washington, and out of that came the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Out of Selma came the Voting Rights Act that Johnson advocated, which is really a very strong measure. And that actually the black people working together, praying together, singing together, going to jail together, dying together, were the real cause of the country's moving to open the gates of opportunity. And then I took the middle part of my speech then had to do with going through the gates and the ability to get through the gates. And this was emphasized in Johnson's speech to Howard University. I don't know whether you remember that or not, but he made a very, very strong speech. It was regarded at the time as being
very strong. I told him at the White House that I thought that was a very strong speech, and he seemed a little surprised himself. But this is what he was talking about. The next phase of this had to be assisting people to have the ability to go through the gates. And so I talked in terms then of what should be done now in regard to that. I mentioned the school, the educational situation. I dealt rather candidly with him about a number of things. For example, that report fairly recently about the fact that over 1 million children between 12 and 17 years of age, black children in the United States, had only the equivalent of fourth grade ability to read and write. So I stressed the point that they'd had 12 years schooling, but only 4 years education. And I mentioned the what I think is the vicious circle in education, you know, of here a child goes to school from a home environment that's almost totally bereft of any cultural advantages or development. And he gets the teacher that comes from the other end of the cycle that he gets involved in. He's pushed right on through grade after grade after grade and passed, though he hasn't really learned the equivalent of what he should have learned at that time in his life. And he goes to a college where the standards are inferior, and so they push people right on through, and then they get qualified as teachers, and then they come back down and start teaching these same inferior teachers come back and are teaching the inferior children. And so what has happened is that our best teachers have been given the easiest jobs, and the least qualified have been given the hardest assignments that they simply were not competent to deliver completely in. Now, and I said to them last night, I said the job that must be done for these children to get the best qualified teaching that they can get, regardless of what the color of the teacher may be. And I mentioned the legal situation. This kind of distresses me, I'm a lawyer. We've got 15% of our people in Florida that are black, and less than 1% of the lawyers in Florida are black. We don't know just exactly how many, because somebody, for some motivation that I don't understand, hides these statistics of whether a lawyer is black or white. As a consequence, you go to the Florida bar, they won't even tell you. They can't tell you. They say how many black lawyers we have. And when they make the application for pass the bar to the bar examining board, why, they don't disclose it there. And for the last two or three sessions, they've told me they've tried to look out over the audience of these people taking the exams, you know, and write down this and that, and they've come up with different figures. And so, but it's ridiculous. But anyhow, it's certainly less than 1%, and that this is wrong. And I said frankly that we are taking more in the Florida law schools that are black. But still, at the rate we're taking them, it's just made a minuscule effort, really, to bridge any gap in equality of opportunity in that field. And I said very frankly that I thought these law schools ought to take more blacks, and that they ought to insist upon making the schools making the adjustments that would allow for that, whether it meant greater budgets or whether it meant changing some of their rules. Well, I still thought they ought to let them in more. There's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court, incidentally from Washington, that's quite a subject of interest now, where a white man who had a LSAT score that was higher than some blacks was denied entrance. So he was suing, claiming that this was denying his equal opportunities by not allowing him to go when they allowed these blacks to go over less of them. The Supreme Court hadn't passed on that.
I thought they sidestepped.
Well, they felt it was moot.
Yeah.
Because
because actually he had come in and graduated. They'd let him on in. So they that's the way they sidestepped that. But then that was the middle part of my talk. Then the third part of my talk had nothing to do with race, really. It had to do with the general malaise in the country, Watergate. And I was trying, really, to bring them into the, to deal with, talk to them as I would talk to any group, not because they were black, but because they were American citizens. And so that was the third part of my, and I dealt with some of the evils that I see on the current national scene, and call for some specific improvements, such things as publicly financed campaigns over and above minimal support from contributors. This is something I think the federal government should start at the president and the congressional level. And we, but I don't think there's any question but that we can see that our democratic processes are hobbled and crippled by virtue of influence that comes from campaign contributors. This is, comes right to the center of whether or not the system can work. You really can't. I think we need to get that freed in order to see if free enterprise can work, because free enterprise can't work under the present system when congressmen, when presidents, when people that are going to run things are beholden to special interests for their right to be there to rule and to govern. So I think this is quite important. So I mentioned several things of this kind in the third part of it.
How they react?
Oh, they were very friendly. We had quite a few candidates down there as guests.
What kind of questions did
they
ask?
We had two Supreme Court judges. We had one cabinet member, the Secretary of Agriculture, state cabinet member. We had Mallory Horn down there, who's president of the Senate and is a candidate for the United States Senate. And we had quite a few, and quite a few candidates for the legislature were there, sprinkled in the group. Pretty good group of people. They were from all over the state. But I'm sure. Now, Dick Pettigrew, for example, is running down in Miami for the United States Senate. And they're dropping the idea, Horn and these others are even now dropping the idea that he is the liberal in the campaign. So they see some advantage from that.
But does that mean the same thing it did 6 years ago?
And I don't think it would mean the same thing as it did 6 years ago, but I think that still a kind of a cold word so far as race relations are concerned, and yet Horn and all these others are actively seeking black help, openly, like his presence there last night.
Is that different than 6 years ago?
Yes, it is. Yes, I believe so.
So there is that change.
Yes.
Still using code words, but still seeking the support of blacks.
Yes, I think so. They're more open about that. But I think this has been an adjustment that has also been contributed to by the fact that the blacks are everywhere in public accommodations, and there's an easing of the tension, you know, that we had.
Would you have had a
few years back?
Would you have had a meeting like the Voters League 6 years ago at something like this downtown Holiday Inn in Tallahassee?
6 years ago, I think so. If that, I don't know if that Holiday Inn was there 6 years ago. I doubt if it's been there quite that long. But
you would not have had, you would not have had the outpouring of public officials there.
No, and I don't think we'd have had it. Yes, I think they were accepting them, of course, in the hotel, black people. But now it's been this was there's a beginning point of that, and then an increasing acceleration, and then just a kind of wide openness.
Were you advising? You went.
And
you,
now everything is wide open in respect to that. Any motel, any hotel, any restaurant. I think you find it's a public one. It holds its patronage out, or its business out to public support. Doesn't hesitate to support any color lines.
Did you have any reluctance to accept the community relations director's job when it was first offered you? When was that, in 64?
Not any real reluctance. I knew it was going to have its problems, but I really felt that this was the big passion, is a term that Oliver Wendell Holmes used. It was a big issue, passion of my time. I didn't feel like I would ever feel right in not becoming involved in it. And trying to just circumvent it, or get around it some way, or deal with it the least possible way. All during the time I was governor, I was dealing with it to the extent that I felt I could and still hold a position of leadership to accomplish so much that I was anxious to accomplish for the state. And what I did as governor would seem very puny now, but in those times, little puny steps were very difficult to take. And public leaders were in position in the South where they could just go so far. And I always used the parallel that they had to stay within the horizon of the people. They got over the horizon. If they got so far out the people couldn't see them, well, they lost their effectiveness and they lost their ability to lead. So while I think public officials, public leaders should be out front, I think they got to stay in the range of people to see and to understand what they're standing for.
What were you assuming?
And I tried to do that as governor. And my turn, when I was governor, there were a lot of things that I didn't do that I would have done since then. And we didn't make any enormous strides in desegregation then, but still we made some. And it was terribly difficult. I remember when the city engine, right after they got started up there in your country, when they started, we had quite a demonstration here. And people were just raving about this thing. It was just, they were terribly resentful that these blacks would want to eat at the lunch counter at the 10-cent store, which seems ridiculous now. But nevertheless, at that time, they were ready to get axe handles and really go to fighting on the streets. And I made a speech on television that was and radio that was carried all over the state on a Sunday afternoon, and it was I didn't have any text, but I just talked it to the people to try to get them to see that we did not want disorder and that we wanted to find proper solutions for these problems and solve them in the communicating back and forth and not out in the streets. Blood and thunder. And I said to them at that time that under the law at that time, that a owner of a store had the legal right to say that he would not allow black people to trade at one count of his store, although he would permit them to trade and welcome them to trade at other places in his store. That while the owner had that legal right, that to me it was morally wrong for a store owner to take that position. And this is kind of the way I talked. I said members of my family won't agree with this, and a lot of my closest friends don't agree to it, but yet that's the way I, as one individual, feel about this. But I don't want us to fight this thing out in the streets. I want us to fight it out in the courts and fight it out within the legal processes of law and struggle to a right conclusion. And good gracious, you'd have thought the that the world was coming to an end almost. It's a horrendous reaction because I said it was morally wrong. It's that simple. The man introduced me down there last night reminded them, because people have remembered that speech unusually well over the years. He said he's the man who said it was morally wrong. If the man wouldn't let us eat a sandwich in the dentist store. And they applauded at that point in his introduction. But
you find that hard to believe, the intensity of those feelings now when you look back?
It is.
You find it hard to believe all the changes that have occurred since then? Could you have anticipated it?
I did not and could not have anticipated it, but I certainly can see it having actually occurred.
I think that's one of the high points of the 6 years you were in the office, the governor's office, presiding over that transition period.
Yes. I count that as one of the things that I did, and I make it up to my responsibility. I wish in retrospect I'd done more, really. Whether I could have gotten by doing more and stayed within the horizon, I don't know. But we just had, you know, those were the times when the lawsuits were just coming, you know. And there's so many areas that were not, that particular thing was not settled until the civil rights, these four big congressional acts came along and cleared up so much. But while they were in, before they came and before the decisions were clarified, people were thinking in terms of this is just going to be a bad nightmare dream that's going to pass away. They didn't even take that Brown decision seriously at first. It made no great big impact on the emotions of people when it first happened. And I think most of the thinking was, well, this is just some screwball opinion up there in the Supreme Court, and smart lawyers can figure ways to get around that. And smart lawyers did try to find ways to get around that. But we were battling we had people here that were trying that interposition route. You remember something about that? And I openly declared my antagonism and resentment about that as something we should do. And the legislature just insisted on passing it. I had no legal way to prevent it. It was a concurrent resolution between the two houses. It wasn't anything if the governor had a chance to do anything but to see that it got filed in the Secretary of State's office when they finally passed it. We defeated it in one session, but we were having several sessions of legislation. And I took the thing when it came across my desk and wrote on the face of it, this is wrong. This issue was settled in the Civil War. And that we've gotten beyond that. And this resolution, I want the record to show that this resolution passed with my open, active opposition, and I resent it as not being a sound process of government at this day and time. So I was, every now and then, you know, out there on the firing line, but I called my county superintendents up to try to get them to start a program of desegregation. And their feeling at the time was, well, and I explained to them that this was the law. We did have to make a beginning and do something about this and move from a small beginning but on to something more. And that they were the ones that should bear the brunt of getting something started. We had a session right over there in the mansion on that. There wasn't but one superintendent who felt that he could do anything right at that time. The rest of them said, we can a little later, Governor, we will be trying. But the one in Dade County did. And the school board in Dade County did. And they took a school that was in a changing neighborhood, but it still was all white. But it's a very logical place to start, and they took a few black children in there. They couldn't hold out, though, because the white children all deserted the school after a little bit, so it became an all-black school. But in the meantime, it had been started made other places in the state.
in the last 25 years, is that the major change in Florida politics, the attitude towards race relations?
No. Is that the only major?
I said, is it the major change that's occurred in the last 25 years?
That and the reapportionment of the legislature, I would count as quite major, too.
How about development?
Can you talk a little bit about the impact of
school development? We had an awful lot of things going about that time. We developed from the beginning, back then, before many of the states had a junior college program that was really very extensive. In my term, in 6 years of government, as governor, we put in 26 community colleges. And they were soundly developed. Community colleges that would give first 2 years of school, of college above the high school, also vocational emphasis related to indigenous employment opportunities and this sort of thing. And these schools, I don't know what we would have done had we not had these schools that have been taking care of a great part of this mushrooming college and university. Student enrollment increases since in our state has been tremendous. And we built another new university right down there in Tampa, the University of South Florida. You may be familiar with it. It's a pretty first-rate institution, I think, now. Well, we built that in our 6 years from Sandsburg to graduating students. I was down for shoveling the first spade of earth to get it started. We had a big battle about where it would be located. Got it located, and then we built it. And I welcomed the first convocation for the first class students that came there, and also participated in the first graduation service. Well, this is just one. We expanded much beyond that, but we laid a real solid basis of educational expansion at that time. This is all the time we were getting the strength of the interstate highway program. And we took a strong position that we ought to concentrate in the cities where the needs were the greatest and not try to see how many miles we could build, but to get some expressways. So we built those expressways in Miami, Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville. And those have just been of enormous impact, really, in accommodating rapid growth of transportation needs. Now we still haven't got that program completed. We laid the foundations and the directions for the way we go in our time. In the area of attracting business to the state, this was a need that we had. It's no longer an important need because it meant about the momentum that we established at that time was terribly important. Because we had fast mushrooming population, but we didn't have the growth and employment opportunities we needed to make it stable and not drift into a situation like California got into, where they were trying to keep people out of the state because of the welfare problems they were getting. So we had a development commission program, organized a development commission. I went to various places all over the East and Midwest, telling the story of Florida opportunity, and we attracted and got numbers of very fine, clean businesses in the state. I thought this was an important part of my program. So race relations, economic development. I served the same 6 years as Luther Hodges served up there in North Carolina, and he was interested in some of these same things. We used to compare notes every now and then.
What was the effect of apportionment?
Reapportionment, we had the worst struggle, I think, of any state in the country, because we tried to do it before the Supreme Court made the state do it. And this was also one of the big things that I concentrated on, because we had the most malapportioned legislature in the United States. We had a county right next to us up here with 11,000 people over here, with a senator in Dade County with a population that it had a million, with one senator. And so this is was a strong, I made a strong effort to get something done in this area. It was almost impossible because of the fact that you just can't get legislation. It had to come through the legislature. We had no way to bypass the legislature, no way of initiative or referendum, anything of this sort. And so I tried to get the legislature itself to reapportion itself. And I had special session after special session after special session. I had the strong support of the press and from all the big cities, of course. And we would make a little progress, and then we finally got a package that really made substantial progress. It didn't do the total thing, but it was a complete maximum that I felt that we could possibly do with that legislature as constituted. And it was my feeling that we ought to go ahead and take that, and then that would be used as steps in, and we'd have a more malleable opportunity to move to a higher level. So we got a referendum on this, and it was submitted to the people, and all these newspapers, this is one of the greatest disappointments I've had in my life, all these same newspapers that had been fighting this battle with me, they took the position that we were accepting a half loaf and that we'd just hold on while we could get the whole loaf, and that they'd better to leave it in a terrible state, an indefensible sort of thing, than to get do a job that could possibly be defended in any way. And they thought it was bad strategy. And so they opposed us in the referendum, and the people voted to die. Then you had the combination of the strength of the papers with all these little counties that were really upset about it. And so they defeated me. I thought that was a loss. I thought then they were mistaken. And I think so now. But after me spending 6 years most of haggling over that issue and trying to get some decency in that area, then the Supreme Court, and I told the legislature that the Supreme Court is going to do this in time, in my opinion, and here it is, our state constitutional mandate. Now we talk about states' rights, states' responsibilities. Why don't we go on and do this? It's our obligation, it's our responsibility. If we don't do it, well, then we're going to find that the United States Supreme Court is going to do it. And I've read to them a little of that Hawaiian decision. I don't know whether you followed this issue much, but some federal judge out in Hawaii really made a very enlightened opinion in this area way ahead of his time. And I said, this is the way of things in the future. But I had to leave there without having done any more than make the people deeply aware of that need.
Am I correct that
then the Supreme Court decision came along, and then they started the process of a reapportionment as required by the courts.
But the battle of reapportionment that you fought actually preceded Baker versus Carr.
Right.
You were acting under
right.
the state constitutional
right.
mandate, and the fact that
right.
Florida had never really, or at least for decades, had not followed its own state constitutional mandate.
Right.
Now, was that state constitutional mandate, did it apply to both houses of the legislature, or was it a little federal system?
It applied to both houses of the legislature, provided that every 10 years, the state was mandated to reapportion its representation. It doesn't say on the basis of population, but to reapportion its legislature and the representation there. And of course, they claim that this didn't mean it could take into account pine trees and bulls and steers and heifers and rutabagas or whatever. The geographic limitations, they were all arguing that this didn't mean that it related to people. But we were mandated to do this every 10 years. Historically, the legislature just passed a reapportionment bill, reapportioned itself just like it was, to meet that mandate. And nobody had been making the fight. Now, Caldwell made a fight, but his was a very minimal fight. I've forgotten exactly the details of what he did, but at least he raised the issue when he was governor back during the war.
When the complete reapportionment based on population came, were the results what you expected in terms of the legislature's operation, the people who go there, and the product, and so on?
Yes. We've had substantial representation from the largest cities, and I do think that the level of intelligence and the level of competence of the legislators has substantially increased. I think the main handicap of it has been that they have kind of gotten the feeling that they were just like little congressmen, and that the main thing was, and the main concern that they had was staying in office. And so all this staff development, I think much of it has been for political purposes. And this aspect of it I have not admired.
How about the legislation they produced?
They've gotten away from the rather pure concept of the citizen legislator. Now, I served in the legislature for 20 years, and there were all kinds of people in there. We had some crooked people and a lot of honest people, but there were a large number of people who were motivated almost totally, if not totally, large numbers, I'd say totally, because of the opportunity to render a public service, and so was getting compensated for it. Well, this was something that was, they used to give us $6 a day for every day the legislature was in session, help defray expenses, and that was all. Because it wasn't, I didn't have much expenses because I live right here. I think we've missed getting some people that would undertake this assignment on the basis of a high level of commitment to public service. At the same time, I think, in all fairness, that the old system could not have worked this time. I think they should be getting some more, but I do think that they should recognize that they ought to have their expenses carefully scrutinized, not only because of the wrong in overdoing for themselves, but in the example that they set to the rest of the government. I don't see how legislative committees and legislators can be too critical of wasted public expenditures when they are guilty of the same kind of waste. That is to say, having more people on the payrolls than they've got, that then are committed to a service that really is in the public interest. That's my big passion now, is that we need government that is committed to the public interest and is not diverted or is not generated because of self-aggrandizement or self-seeking. This is what I think this country needs desperately. So I said this down in that speech last night, too. We've got to come around to the fact that these are public service people. The public has to be the dominant. The public service has to be dominant in their thinking, and not what they can do in response to what effort is made to influence them for some special purpose, you know, that is often not consistent with the public interest.
The defenders of the large staffs and the higher salaries and the greater expenses contend that that has the effect of making the legislators more independent, that their staffs put them in a position of not having to depend on lobbyists and special interest information, and that the greater salaries and expenses allow a broader range and more people to serve, people who couldn't have afforded to just serve on their own.
My guess is that we have 50 lobbyists right here now for every one we had 20 years ago, or before this mushroom started.
large part of the income of the Tallahassee lawyers comes from lobbying activity, much, much larger than used to be the case. Now, of course, there's more business going on in the state. You've got home builders, for example, development people. We didn't have a great deal of effort by them. They have an enormous effort now. So I guess you can explain, but I don't think that's a sound assumption that there's any less lobbying effort or any less productive.
Well, there was a question of less lobbying.
Or more.
I think they were contending that the individual lobbyist had less influence. I don't know. Getting back,
I'd rather question that.
Getting back, Governor, to your the time you made that speech.
Y'all want some more coffee? Last year as governor was the year of 60. I went out first in 61. I think it's been 59.
You said there was a tremendous reaction to that speech. Was any overt threats made?
Oh, yeah. We had crosses burned down.